I wanted to go through some applications of Gauss-Kadatsi. And the particular applications I'm going to be discussing are where we're dealing with manifolds of codimension one. And so what I have in mind there, in particular, is where the codimension one submanifold is actually a boundary. So the first thing that I'll discuss will be the Einstein-Hilbert action and how the addition of a boundary term makes the variational principle, sort of closes off that little loophole of having to impose that derivatives of the metric vanish on the boundary as well as the metric itself. So, so that's our first concrete example, gravitational action and the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So this is now going to make the gravitational action a little bit more coherent, make it make more sense. So if we remember, right, so I've simply reiterated the result that we found when we looked at the variational principle for Einstein's equations. The Einstein-Hilbert action is the integral of r root g. We vary the integral of r root g. We get a minus a half rgab coming from varying square root of g. We've got the rab delta gab as part of the variation of the Ricci scalar. But then we also have to integrate by parts, and so that comes from delta RAB, and we get a boundary term. And at the time, I commented that it was a little bit of a cheat to kind of ignore that because it's beyond the usual rules of the game. So now what we're going to do is we're going to try and add a boundary term to the gravitational action to take care of this slightly illegal integral here. Okay, so that's the philosophy is simply to find something that is geometric pertaining to the boundary that's going to cancel off this unwanted term. Now, if we look at this, the general shape of this, what we've got here is this is a normal derivative of the trace of the variation of the metric. And then this is another combination. It's a sort of divergence of the trace, again, contracted with a normal tensor. Now, in terms of thinking about this normal this morning, we saw that our boundary, so we've got our manifold here, and so this is our space-time, and then we're kind of imagining that we've got some boundary to the space-time, delta m, and so this is our normal, so this is a Gauss-Kadazy setup with codimension one. And we also know that we've got the features of the properties of the boundary. We have that the derivative of n, or the covariant derivative of n, gives us the extrinsic curvature. But we can also, if we think about what the extrinsic curvature is, which is this projected covariant derivative of n, if we're thinking about contractions such as, I guess, something like n grad of something to do with the metric, if we think about derivatives of the normal, sorry, of the first fundamental form and contract those with the normal, that's also a sort of different way of writing the extrinsic curvature. Yep. Quite possibly. Where? In where? Del n, that's, yeah, sorry, that's just, sorry. This is the covariant derivative along n, so it's na grad a. Just shorthand, yeah. Just being lazy. So this is our, let me say, it's Gauss-Kadazy, codimension one. And I'm going to just take my normal to be space-like, because usually if we're doing a variational principle, the boundary will often be some boundary at some, say, fixed position, or a boundary off at infinity, but quite often time is running along our boundary. So in that case, what I'll have is a definite sign. So if n is space-like, then my first fundamental form, HAB, is going to be GAB plus NA NB. So that's what that's telling me. So now that's sort of going to motivate me to look for a boundary term which involves the extrinsic curvature, because over there I've got derivatives of delta G. So if I think about taking a derivative of H here, I pick up extrinsic curvature terms. So it's possibly plausible that maybe derivatives of delta G are going to have some extrinsic curvature type of dependence. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at K. Okay, so that's a scalar. It's a scalar which makes sense for a submanifold, because it's telling you about the embedding of that submanifold in the ambient manifold. So it's got physical information in it. It may be an extrinsic, giving you information about an embedding rather than some intrinsic curvature, but it still has some meaning. So for the variational principle, let me just note here. So if I'm looking specifically at that problem, my delta H will be zero. So let me just see what happens to this boundary scalar under a variation. So the extrinsic curvature was just the symmetrized covariant derivative of n. Therefore, its trace is just the divergence of n. And so if I want to vary that, then I pick up a piece, which is the divergence of the variation of n, and then another piece, which is telling me about changes in the covariant derivative, changes in the connection. So this is what I'm going to work with, but we know that delta gamma So again, I'm trying to get everything in terms of the inverse metric, delta of inverse metric. So that's the first, or rather the second term dealt with. And then so I want to rewrite the variation in the normal vector in terms of some expression involving delta G, because where I'm trying to head with this is I'm trying to go from this scalar, which I'm integrating over the boundary, taking its variation, and I'm hoping I'm going to get something that looks like this, okay? That's the game I'm playing. And I know that the variation of the metric on the boundary is contained within its normal components because delta HAB is zero. So the only variation of G is really looking at the variation of the normal vector. And so that's basically what this relation is saying. It's saying that the variation of G comes from the variation of the normals. And then I'm contracting this expression with two n's. And my variation of delta Na is just given by, it's got to be proportional to the normal. So it's given by this expression. And so I simply replace the contraction of delta n along NB with an expression involving G, delta G. So at the moment, I'm just really setting up the stall there. What I've done is I've now expressed the variation of the scalar K in terms of delta G. So I've just got to do a couple of manipulations on this. So what I've got once I input delta Na in terms of delta G and the variation of the Christoffel symbol. So now, if I look at this first term, I can see when this covariant derivative hits the first n, it gives me a divergence of n, which is just minus a half k. When it hits the second n, it's going to give me an extrinsic curvature, but the extrinsic curvature is going to be contracted against the normal, and those two are orthogonal, so I don't get anything from the covariant derivative hitting either of these ends, because it's saying grad n of n, which is zero. And so the only other contribution I get here now, this piece I'm quite happy with because that's that term there. So I'm sort of feeling that, well, this is looking promising, but I'm going to have to work with this particular expression to try and get it into this format here. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to look at this pair here, these two ends. I'm going to notice that because of the definition of the first fundamental form, a pair of normals together can be re-expressed as H minus G. So this is really H minus delta CA. Okay, now if I look here, I've got n grad delta g, and with the opposite sign, grad n of delta g. So this expression here is now of the right form. And now all I've got to do is just have a little look at what's left over and see if there's anything to worry about there, any sort of unwanted junk. Now, this here, I can pull my n inside and say that I've actually now got the divergence of the sort of mixed component of delta G. And then I've got to subtract off the covariant derivative of N. But the covariant derivative of n is just an extrinsic curvature. So here I've got delta k is going to be equal to one half k a b minus k Na and B, delta G. And then, of course, if I've got if I've got my boundary term being to have a root g as well for my boundary term. Oh, I mean, no, there, don't I? And actually, I've just dropped this. Let me put it in. I've dropped that total derivative. The reason I can drop the total derivative now is because I'm already on a boundary. So normally, if you have a total derivative, the integral of a total derivative throughout a volume is equal to, so the integral of, I think my indices have gone astray on this again. So this is a divergence of a particular vector living on the boundary. So normally you'd say, well, the integral of the divergence of the vector would be the vector evaluated on the boundary. However, you're already living on a boundary, and the boundary of a boundary is zero, so this integral just gives nothing at all. There's no boundary at all, therefore that integral vanishes. And so what I've got here is that if I take my full gravitational action as my Einstein-Hilbert action, minus the integral of k on the boundary, minus 1 over 8 pi g, then these terms, the terms involving the derivative of g on the boundary, actually vanish. And so since I want to use it in my second application, I'll just write it down. So delta S grav is now going to equal at managing to knock this thing off. So for the moment, if we're just concerned with a variational principle, that second term vanishes because the variation of h is zero, so delta g has only got components normal to the boundary, but both of the expressions inside this bracket, k and h, live parallel to the boundary. So in terms of this contribution just doesn't contribute when you're just looking at finding equations of motion for the bulk. Okay? So what that means is I want to know what's going on in the bulk of my space-time, in the volume. I'm not really interested in the boundary, so I put a boundary on, I fix it, and I fix the metric on the boundary, and I find that all I've now got, legitimately, is my Einstein tensor in the bulk. And so that gives me my Einstein equations. So that's, in terms of saying this is now a correct way of defining or finding the Einstein equations, that's all very well, but it sounds a bit nitpicky, okay? If just, oh, well, we've now made it proper. What's interesting about it is, number one, that because we have now written down a full action, and this boundary term is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. Doing a good job today, looking all right, dog's breakfast. What I've now got is an action which I've tweaked my gravitational action here. So now I could ask whether, if I have a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations, in other words, where the Ricci tensor and scalar are zero, it's not so clear that the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term is going to be zero. So this now gives me a way of computing the action of a solution and actually seeing if I get a different answer for different Einstein spaces. So that's number one. And then the second point is, I stressed when I was talking about this as a variational principle, that if we're just interested in what's going on in the bulk, in our volume, we just fix a boundary and we just say that boundary is rigid, nothing happens, the metric doesn't change. But I could imagine a situation where my boundary is dynamical and interacting with the bulk, in which case I would pick up this second term. So those are the two applications that I now want to take each in turn, looking at computing gravitational actions and then at dynamical boundaries. So, I'm going to take the Schwarzschild solution because that's a nice example of a Ricci flat manifold where it's a vacuum solution. And I'm going to look at computing the Euclidean action. Because most often when you want to calculate actions, you're operating in Euclidean section. So, I'll describe what I'm going to do with the boundary. So the reason here is, the particular application here is where Gibbons and Hawking first came up with this boundary term was because they were exploring the Euclidean analog for black hole thermodynamics. So, as I mentioned, a sort of cheat's way of finding temperatures of black holes is to Euclideanize the metric and then see the periodicity of Euclidean time. And so that seemed like a really nice correspondence. So can you push it further? Because if you want to derive all the other thermodynamic quantities of a black hole, you could imagine taking a partition function approach where you're computing the actions of the solutions that you're dealing with. So you're basically going to integrate over all possible geometries that have that periodicity of Euclidean time. And so that's kind of where this is coming from. So in this case, the boundary is going to be at large R, and it's simply really an analytic continuation of, say, a Lorentzian boundary at large R. But you want the Euclidean action because here you're looking at, well, I guess it's not even true that it's positive definite, but as long as you tread carefully on the tightrope, you can make some sense of this partition function approach. So that was the motivation of Gibbons and Hawking to introduce this boundary term. So we've already looked at this geometry, and we saw that it was in the tau R plane, looked like a cigar, and time was periodic with periodicity 8 pi gm. And so in terms of computing an action, the Einstein-Hilbert term vanishes because the Ricci scalar vanishes. And so the action of Euclidean Schwarzschild is a pure boundary term. So it's the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So in this case, it's going to give us right, so I want to compute the extrinsic curvature of a boundary at large R. So that's what I'm going to do. So let's say this here is my cutoff. You'll see why I want to introduce a cutoff in a moment. So I'm cutting off my geometry at large R. The boards down while I'm about it. Okay, so that's my boundary metric at some finite R. And then my normal here, this is going to be my normal, which will be inward pointing because you always take the normal in the manifold itself. So my normal N has its unit normal, so I've got to include that square root of 1 minus 2 gm on R there to make sure it's a unit normal. And then my extrinsic curvature K is going to be given by the divergence of that normal in the manifold. Okay, so remember that a divergence of a vector is 1 over root g partial derivatives root g, so that's what I've done there. And of course, at the moment, I'm looking for the radial derivative, so I haven't put any r's, and I then want to evaluate that at r equals r. Okay, so you can see that there's a term which is going to be minus 2 on R, the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on R. So that comes from differentiating the R squared. And then I've got to differentiate the square root. So that gives me a gm on R squared from that part. And then, I guess, divide by the square root of 1 minus 2gm on R. Okay. So my boundary term, so it's so if I integrate over this surface, I've got an integral d tau, I've got an integral of sine theta d phi. So that's all of those pieces. And then I've got the volume factor, which is going to be R squared into 1 minus 2gm on R to the half. And then I've got to add in my K term. So I get the length of my periodicity of my time direction. I've got a 4 pi coming from the integral over theta and phi. And then I've just got this remaining part, which is dependent on R. It's 2 over R, isn't it, there? So that's 2. Okay. So that was the reason that I put a cutoff at a finite R, because, as you see, this is linearly divergent. So, the problem appears to be I'm trying to compute a boundary term here, and the boundary term is divergent. However, notice that there's no mass in that divergence. It's linearly divergent, but it's only dependent on the periodicity of Euclidean time and not dependent on the black hole mass. So if I put m equals 0, I'd still have this divergence. And so this is telling me that flat space will have also a divergence in its gravitational action. And so what I need to do is to perform a subtraction. So I have to subtract off the flat space divergence. So what we have to do is we have to subtract off a component which is flat space at exactly the same temperature. So what I have to do is I have to construct, rather than the cigar, I have to take my cylinder, which is what flat space at finite temperature would be. That would be R and tau again. And I have to subtract the action of this away. Now, it's not just crossing out that beta R on G term. And the reason is that if I wrote down explicitly what my three-dimensional metric was, so I have to have my ds three-dimensional flat at r equals capital R has to be the same as this. So I have to match those boundaries. So it means that I am putting something which is actually at a slightly different temperature to, than the black hole temperature, because I've truncated this sig r at finite r. The period, although the periodicity of tau is 8 pi gm, tau is not quite got, is not a sort of a unit coordinate. There's not one multiplying d tau there. So in that case, what that means is that when I compute my extrinsic curvature, then my extrinsic curvature I can borrow from the expression I calculated for the Schwarzschild case, but set m equals zero, because I'm using the bulk, the same expression there, but without a mass. However, when I do my volume factor, it's going to have a gm on r in it. So in flat space, I simply have that my extrinsic curvature of the boundary is just 2 on r, but my action is then equal to, well, I've still got this beta over 2g term, but now if I look at my k times the volume integral, k is 2 on r, and then the, where did I put it? Let's see if I can find it somewhere. Oh, yes. So the volume measure there is now just simply going, is going to be the same. It's going to be r squared square root of 2gm on r. So this is the expression that I get. Now, I'm large R, so I can simply Taylor expand my square root. And so what I get finally is minus beta R on G, as advertised, plus beta M. So in other words, yes, I've got the same linearly divergent piece, but I've also picked up a second term, which is a constant. And so when I subtract the action of flat space from the action of Schwarzschild, I end up, so my regularized action, is simply beta m on 2. So that's the Euclidean action of Schwarzschild. So, yep, yeah, I thought I was going to get a question from there. I could see it in your face, yeah. Mm? Yeah. So normally, so the reason for subtracting flat space is exactly like this idea of saying if the vacuum also has infinite action, right, then that's indicative that you've got to have a regularization procedure. And so Normally, what you're interested in, if you assume that the vacuum is your ground state, okay, then normally what you do is you say, well, the action of my solution is, you know, this bare action that I compute, and then I subtract off the action of the vacuum, what I call the vacuum. So I'm basically re-zeroing my computation such that the Euclidean action of the vacuum of flat space is zero. So I'm shifting the zero. I happen to be shifting it by an infinite amount, but we're kind of used to that. So that's what I'm doing here. Okay. Why that? No doubt. Yeah. So what you have to do, if you're going to subtract off, you've got to subtract like from like, okay? And so, as I was saying, that you have to subtract flat space, which is at the same temperature as the Schwarzschild solution. Now, once I truncate, if I truncate my Schwarzschild solution at this R here, then the metric on the boundary is like an S2 cross an S1, right? But the S1, the d tau squared piece, does not have length delta tau, right? The length of a single circuit in tau space there is actually beta times the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on R. So what that means is I'm not quite at the temperature beta inverse, okay? Because the real length of my circle is not quite the periodicity of tau because of that factor 1 minus 2 gm on R. So you have to compare like with like if you're doing a background subtraction. So in essence, you're saying that here's my cigar. I'm truncating it at some finite radius. I've got to compare that to a cylinder, right? And I have to have the two geometries being identical. So I could either represent this as a cylinder with metric dt squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared, where the periodicity of this time coordinate was just slightly different. Or I could say that was actually, you know, d tau squared 1 minus 2 gm on r plus r squared d omega 2 squared with the same periodic tau. So I can do it either way. I either say I've got this is the metric on my cylinder, because don't forget r's just a constant here. This is the metric on my cylinder. The periodicity is the same as the periodicity of the black hole Euclidean time. And then, you know, that I guess I was in the back of my mind doing that when I was writing that down. Alternatively, I could say I am in a standard S2 cross S1 here. And then my beta would be different because now the periodicity of this capital T is not the same as the periodicity of tau. It's totally equivalent because you've got the same square root there. So you have to subtract like from like. You've got to subtract the flat space at the same temperature as this particular part of this manifold. And when you're truncating at finite R, you're kind of shifting it's like you've got an effective local temperature, which is different from the temperature you see at infinity. So now you can use this Euclidean action to input into a partition function approach to derive thermodynamic variables, you know, using a partition function approach. So I have the idea Anna wants you to do some of that tomorrow in the tutorial, so there you go, that's something to look forward to. Now in the few minutes remaining, I want to now just try and give an idea of what happens now if you go back to this variation and say, I'm actually interested in the situation where my boundary is dynamical. So this is a sort of brain type of approach. And so this is something known as the Israel equations. And Israel derived them in the 60s because he was interested in looking at shells of matter. So typically, when you want to try and solve a full general relativistic problem, if you try and take into account every last bell and whistle, you're going to end up with a really complicated problem on your hands that's analytically intractable. However, sometimes you can strip away a lot of the details and end up with a simplified problem that is analytically tractable. So an example might be if you're looking at say, a sheet of dust, you could approximate that by a thin shell of dust. Another way is you could explore, I guess if you were thinking about gravitational collapse, you could, if you wanted to do that without having access to a computer, you might think, well, instead I look at a shell of matter, a shell of dust, and watch what happens as that collapses inwards. So these are some examples where you can use this idea of a thin shell formalism. So the Israel equations give Einstein's equations. And so the idea is that you make your boundary now dynamical. And so what you've got on the gravitational side, or the Einstein side, you've got some bulk Einstein equations, and now you've got this extra term on the boundary, KAB minus KHAB. So the setup for Israel's equation is you imagine you've got some very thin shell of matter, and you regard that as two components, two manifolds, if you like, each with a boundary. And then you think of this, your submanifold, so you're thinking your full manifold is the whole thing. And in the approximation that this thin shell is infinitesimally thin, your full manifold would be the union of these two. But each half has a boundary. The boundaries have to be identical. And so sigma is just delta of either m plus or m minus. And so the Israel equations simply say that if you have So the idea is you've got some energy momentum which is localized on a hypersurface. And so what that translates into is a notion of a delta function. This is what's localizing you on sigma. And so this SAB is meant to represent the sort of, is now a regular part. So you've got a delta function, energy momentum tensor, which is a delta, if you set up coordinates, which were, say, the wall was at z equals 0, then it would be delta of z. So that's the idea. And then it says, sort of looking at what we've just derived, if we had our Einstein equations, we would essentially have that KAB minus KHAB getting a bit low there. So here, I'm just going to note that this is an averaging. That note that there's sort of the normal jumps across the surface. So the Israel equations are simply saying that the jump in extrinsic curvature, and it is like if I flipped the sign of n minus, I would flip the sign of k minus. So normally the Israel equations are written as a jump, a difference in the extrinsic curvature. Then the jump in extrinsic curvature is related to the energy momentum of this line source. So I'd just like to demonstrate this. As an example, by going back to this domain wall that we looked at last week. I think it was last week. So we had a kink solution to a scalar field theory where the scalar field went from one vacuum on one side to a different vacuum on the other side of space. And we saw that the energy momentum tensor of the kink was roughly, so SAB was roughly something like sigma times HAB, where H we now know is this first fundamental form. So the energy momentum tensor of the wall only had non-zero components parallel to the wall, and parallel to the wall, they were proportional to the metric. And so in that case, that tells us what our 8 pi g SAB is. Now, I claimed that the domain wall was really just a hyperboloid sitting in vacuum. So let's look at what we've got for the equations, you know, of the hyperboloid as an embedded submanifold. So a hyperboloid is going to be r squared minus t squared going to equal some length scale, whatever the radius of the hyperboloid is. And so our embedding of the submanifold is going to look like this. So I've chosen my coordinates, sigma a, are tau theta and phi. So tau is like a proper time, and theta and phi are just our normal angles. So my x, how do I know it's proper time, the tau? If I take x dot, then I have a unit vector, which is my unit velocity. So that's my four velocity of an observer at fixed theta and phi. So my normal, with its indices downstairs, is so here, I've got velocity normal, my extrinsic curvature. Remember, it's the covariant derivative of the normal. So gamma r theta is just like r. Nr is the Cosh tau on lambda. But evaluated on the hyperboloid, my r is lambda Cosh tau on lambda. And so this is just equal to, guess that's 1 on lambda times r squared, which is g theta, or h theta. So that's k theta. And then for my time component, k tau, remember that was equal to minus n mu grad tau of x dot. So again, that's going to be the proper acceleration. So n nu is sin ch here, and then for so what I have to do is I have to take both components, both the derivative of, so I'm taking grad tau of x dot mu, which has both a time and a radial component. So I have to sum the time and radial component of the normal. So that's what that expression is there. And that's minus 1 on lambda. So what I've shown here is that the extrinsic curvature is proportional to the intrinsic metric, which is what I would expect for something which had an energy momentum tensor proportional to the metric. Now, there's only one slight sort of little thing that's slightly swept under the carpet here is what I've done is I've computed the extrinsic curvature of this hyperboloid, just one copy of it, okay? So k is minus 1 on lambda times my intrinsic metric. Now, the Israel equations, if I take two mirror images, so I'm going to take two copies of my hyperboloid and glue them together, okay? Then that means my k plus and k minus are the same. And so I'm getting minus 1 on lambda. It's suppose I should write it as HAB. So that's my K. I then have to take the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Okay. But of course, the trace here, trace of H, H is just three-dimensional in four dimensions. And so this becomes minus 3 on lambda. And so I get that 2 on lambda is 4 pi g sigma. And so it's telling me that the radius of this hyperboloid is inversely proportional to the energy density of the wall. It's also... Sorry, I should have put the N here. It's also kind of justifying. I think when I first talked about the metric of the domain wall, I was dealing with something which was not infinitesimally thin. The wall had a finite thickness. And I based my coordinates on the wall. I integrated across the wall, and I found a metric. But then I commented, oh, but the metric away from the wall is actually flat. And you can do a coordinate transformation to make it flat, but the coordinate transformation making that metric flat kind of curved the wall. And so I said at the time, but it was probably fairly mysterious, that what the wall space-time really was two copies of the interior of hyperboloids glued together. And so this gives, from a different perspective, this is saying, from a large-scale perspective, the wall is infinitesimally thin. I use this in Israel formalism, and I use the equations of motion that I get using a boundary concept for the wall, and I end up with exactly the same space-time. So I glue together two hyperboloids, and I end up with an energy source across the join, and that's the wall. So hopefully we're back to normal tomorrow and a 9 o'clock lecture. But